President Biden's decision to call for changing the Senate's rules to pass voting rights protections was a long time coming. Perhaps, in the view of his most disaffected supporters, too long. A self-proclaimed institutionalist who spent more than three decades abiding by those rules as a senator, Joe Biden repeatedly defended the often arcane procedures of the U.S. Senate, even as Republicans used them to block his agenda, and he came under increasing pressure from liberal activists in his own party to rethink his position. Those rules, he said, with admiration more than a decade ago, were about compromise and moderation, a core part of his political identity. To support changing them would be to admit that the principles he so cherished had withered in a city now consumed by partisan rancor. On Tuesday, 11th of January, Joe Biden made that admission. The threat to our democracy is so great that we must find a way to pass these voting rights bills, he said in an impassioned speech in Atlanta, Georgia, on the grounds of Morehouse College and Clark Atlanta University. He added, "Debate them, vote, let the majority prevail, and if that bare minimum is blocked, we have no option but to change the Senate rules, including getting rid of the filibuster." President Biden said that he had been having these quiet conversations with members of Congress for the last 2 months, in the hope of reaching the kinds of negotiated agreements that he pursued as a senator. "I'm tired of being quiet," he said. It is far from clear that President Biden's words will succeed in convincing the most prominent opponent of a rule change among Senate Democrats, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, to help break the Republican logjam on voting rights legislation. On Tuesday, Joe Manchin said again that he opposed getting rid of the filibuster, which allows the minority party to block legislation that fails to garner 60 votes. Some of Joe Biden's closest allies said they remain deeply frustrated by the president's willingness to lead from behind on the issue of voting rights. "We had hoped he would have used his bully pulpit a long time ago for voting rights, and we wouldn't be at this critical junction," said Helen Butler, a black Democrat who was removed from a local election board in Morgan County, Georgia, after a state law gave Republicans more power over such appointments. "This is about retaining America and, as he put it, the soul of America," she said. Democrats are trying to prevent Republicans from blocking voting rights legislation, said they were pleased that President Biden had finally come around, and they are hopeful, but realistic, that his voice may help to convince a handful of senators to back a change in the filibuster rules in the days ahead. Senator Tim Kaine, a Virginia Democrat who has been leading talks to amend the rules, said, "Mr. Biden came into office with a particular obligation on his shoulders to stand up for voter rights in the wake of the violent assault on the Capitol last January as his election victory was being certified. When somebody who understands the Senate and loves it as much as he does says it's time to make a change to accomplish a paramount result that the nation needs, it does have an effect," Tim Kaine said. For some presidents, choosing to support a change in Senate rules to protect voting rights might also have foreshadowed a broader awakening of the realization that the Senate was no longer a place where partisanship could be put aside for the good of the country. That is certainly the view of many in his own party, who assert that far-reaching legislation like the president's Build Back Better package and gun control proposals are doomed to falter without wholesale changes to the Senate's rules. In effect, they argue that today's intense partisanship has led to an ideological stalemate that justifies burning down the House in the name of progress on many fronts. He should have made this much more a priority of his administration, said Fred Wertheimer, the founder and president of Democracy 21, a group pushing for changes to the Senate rules. Fred Wertheimer added, but he still can make a critical contribution by speaking out and by actively and forcefully engaging in the battle. Charles McKinney, the Neville Frierson Bryan Chair of Africana Studies at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee, said President Biden's address on Tuesday must not be the end of his efforts to make progress. Okay, you give your little speech, say the things that you need to say in Georgia, Charles McKinney said, describing his message to the president on Tuesday. And then you need to be making your way back to D.C. President Biden left no doubt that he has reached a breaking point when it comes to voting rights, lashing out at the holdouts in the Senate and comparing them to some of the country's most infamous races. In doing so, he made no distinction between the Senate's Republicans and a handful of Democrats who are standing in the way of the legislation. "Do you want to be on the side of Dr. King or George Wallace?" he declared, prompting some gasps from supporters in the audience. "Do you want to be on the side of John Lewis or Bull Connor? Do you want to be on the side of Abraham Lincoln or Jefferson Davis?" But for Joe Biden, the slow-moving evolution from protector of the Senate rules to a president open to getting rid of the filibuster to advance voting rights legislation hardly appears to be part of a wholesale transformation in his approach to governing in the modern era. Even as White House officials previewed Joe Biden's remarks on Monday night, they went out of their way to insist that he remained an institutionalist, an acknowledgement that Biden's willingness to change has its limits. Tim Kaine said the president viewed the need to protect voting rights as a special responsibility, separate from the other parts of his policy agenda. Tim Kaine added he probably wouldn't be leaning into Senate rules reform proposals on any other issue, even issues that he thinks are very, very important. I can't imagine him probably, you know, making recommendations to the Senate about what we do with rules on any topic other than this. Joe Biden's own words over the years support that conclusion. In July of 2020, as a candidate for president, Joe Biden hinted that his long-standing support for the Senate's filibuster rules might have weakened a bit. Asked whether he supported eliminating the filibuster, Biden said he was open to the possibility. "It's on how obstreperous they have become," he said, "of Republicans, but I think you're going to just have to take a look at it." At pressure to pass voting rights legislation increased, Joe Biden was still hesitant. He said last month he would support changing Senate rules to pass voting rights bills, but noted, "I don't think we may have to go that far." Joe Biden understands the political dangers of moving slowly amid significant shifts in opinion among supporters and the broader public. As he left the White House to travel to Georgia on Tuesday, 11th of January, the president was asked what he risked by fighting for voting rights legislation, a reference to the political dangers of promising more than he can deliver. "I risk not saying what I believe. That's what I risk," Joe Biden said. "This is one of those defining moments. It really is. People are going to be judged. Where were they before and where were they after the vote? History is going to judge this," he said.
Allah Muslims in Spain. The water erupts and flows through the Alcázar Garden, part of Seville, Spain, in which the royal household is located. This place is also considered the official area of the central government. More than 10 centuries ago, Muslims ruled over this land. Abdulrahman III, Caliph of Córdoba, ordered the construction of these buildings. That was when the historical triangle of big Islamic capitals of Andalus, Córdoba, Granada came into being. Gradually, Alcázar became the center of cultural life in the city. Alcázar is also a prime example of architecture that shows the elegance of a civilization, which is still an immeasurable part of the Al-Andalus identity. This majestic example of architecture, even after being recaptured by the Christians, retained its elegance and was developed by Muslim architects once again. Outside these walls, Giralda can be seen. The mosque's minaret is adjacent to the Alcázar Castle. This minaret, which is currently being used as the Catholic Church steeple, became the international symbol of Seville City. This is one of the famous historical landmarks in the capital city, Al-Andalus.
La población en general y también...
Historically, people, academia, and politicians have always noticed the importance of the Islamic Seville in its own era. Seville played an important role, both in the time of war and peace. Even today, the name of Seville can be found in political books. There are also other proven facts, such as immigrants that can be seen in the streets or working in institutions in the city of Seville.
Every day, thousands of tourists, mostly Muslims from every corner of the globe, visit their historical heritage. They can't help thinking about the past, the time when things were better for Muslims. This statement holds true for this neighborhood and the ones on the outskirts of Seville, where many Muslim immigrants, mostly Moroccan, reside. This neighborhood has been devastated by economic strife, unemployment, and a lack of social resources. The basement of this building, which isn't easily noticed, is one of the 6 mosques in the town. Perhaps it is better to describe it as something more like a hall for the Muslim community to perform their religious rituals in. This place is located among the malls and business centers that used to thrive in the past.
Assalamu alaikum, yo soy Jihad.
Hi, I'm Jihad Sarasua from Seville, Al-Andalus. I'm a Muslim. We are in Ishbilia Mosque that we built in the Emeid neighborhood, so Muslims could perform their rituals. This is one of the popular neighborhoods of Seville, where many of us are living together. This mosque was built to meet today's needs of the Muslim community. This is all we have in this neighborhood. This neighborhood belongs to the working class, so this place is okay considering the fact that there is no business or social centers here. We have to, as Muslims, build up a community in such a poor condition. But we need a place where Muslims of Seville can get together to display the true image of Muslim communities, right? Yes, of course, we need that. We are working hard to get what we want. We need a proper neighborhood to show the splendid image of Islam in Seville.
Probably asking the municipality on behalf of the Muslim community of the city would make them grant us a loan. We could use it for Bujeira Mosque, located in Mila de Oro, Seville. We also have historical background in our favor. The constructions will be close to the Alcázar Castle, one of the greatest preserved treasures from the Caliphates. There we meet Javier Fito, one of the residents of Seville who is defending his Muslim community's right to a place where they can perform their rituals and congregations.
As far as I know, most of the mosques are in the basements of buildings. Sometimes these places get really crowded and there is also a lack of space under standard conditions. In the best case scenario, we can only have access to emergency exits. We don't even have the basic conditions here. Trying to have the right place is what we can do to make this situation better. Mosques are supposed to be social centers and community spaces, just like Catholic churches or any other social centers. We should have a better place for public use. What we have right now is still far away from what we have in mind. These places are really cramped. These buildings are not designed for religious purposes. Therefore, problems like poor standards of hygiene arise.
This is what the Muslim community has been struggling against for 25 years. These struggles started when some people in Seville who had converted to Islam openly asked for a proper mosque. While other religious communities had a better situation, they continued to struggle because they had to gather in unsuitable places to pray together.
There are some lecture halls for praying in the basements, lower floors or on the outskirts of Seville. There is no congregational mosque in Dole in spite of efforts to have one.
The idea of building this mosque became a contentious issue in the 90s. At that time, I was a member of the city council and I held the position until 2003. It all started when the Muslim community went to the municipality to get them convinced to have a congregational mosque. Well, personally, I believe that almost everyone in the municipality and political parties there liked the idea, because the idea had a sense of mutual respect and religious freedom. It's quite natural, isn't it? So, different religions can have their own place to perform their rituals. There could also be some other aspects in addition to having a mosque. At the beginning, it seemed that there was no problem with it. There were talks about renting a place for that purpose in Seville, somewhere that had traces of Islamic traditions. Everything passed so quickly and there was no result. They noticed it would be problematic to convert an old church into a mosque in the center of the city. They wanted more than that. It was more affordable to have it built in a new neighborhood. That was when they looked at Bermejal as an option, right?
This is the mosque in Seville. The only accepted and known mosque in the city that we can talk about as a mosque without any inhibitions is this one. Especially when the famous footballer Frederick Knut bought this place and gave it to Al-Ikhwan al-Muslimun, who, after some failed attempts to build a mosque, took the initiative and managed this place.
We gathered at Al-Andalus Parliament to talk it out with MPs and PSOE. Then we asked for the place, just like what other religious communities had, a place with good conditions and enough space for public use. Then we officially registered our request, and after 2 months we got our answer. We had an agreement to allot a place to the Muslim community. It was out of the city with no other buildings around, and we had no other way but to accept it. After a while, we noticed it wouldn't be that bad in the distant future. We accepted it, and we did the paperwork, and we even got the deeds and documents.
Now they have started working on the construction of this mosque on the land which belonged to the Muslim community. The responsibility was given to this young architect from Seville, and they started the project with a predetermined fund of more than 3 million euros. This mosque was supposed to be one of the biggest mosques in Europe, a building of 3,000 square meters, two floors, a capacity of more than 2,000 people, a public yard and a private parking lot. A mosque which would finally give the Muslims of this city a place to congregate. And of course, the rest of the people of Seville would be able to enjoy the modern atmosphere of the place in which followers of different religions and schools of thought could gather to swap ideas and information.
El volumen principal, como no puede ser de otra forma, es la nave que hace de oratorio.
The original structure was a ship of two floors with a dome covered by green tiles. Undoubtedly, genders are separated in accordance with the Islamic law. So the first floor would be used by men and the second floor by women. In the center, we have two hollow places leading to the dome. And in the front, we have the qibla, with a somewhat upward slope to show a symbolic feature which can only be seen in a mosque. Around the main yard, we would have different services. Some of them were considered for public use and some of them more private, such as a halal restaurant, a cafeteria, a library, and a place for other cultural activities, originally designed to be used as a cultural environment for public use.
أشهد أن محمدا رسول الله.
Now that we had the land, the project was presented, accepted, and funded to start. Everything was ready to end 10 years of marginalization. It was almost impossible for the growing number of Muslims in Seville to dream of a mosque, but then everything went wrong.
Soon, a rumor went around that a mosque was going to be built, something that wasn't easy to hide. It didn't seem bad or something that neighbors wouldn't like. The idea of building a mosque wasn't against the society or any other religious sects. Well, it's hard to find an old church in the city center district. It's obvious that we can't find a space in the city center. That's why the idea of building new neighborhoods came up. Normally, in an old neighborhood, the government had already monopolized the land and any other construction activities. Everything was running smoothly until the neighbors found out about the mosque, and they reacted badly against it.
Las personas del barrio en que se iba a plantear la...
The neighborhood was biased against building a mosque.
De alguna manera...
Biased, yes. Most of these immigrants from the West are economically down. And in most cases, they cannot even meet their basic needs. It's not right to think of keeping the poor and the immigrants away from yourself. We shouldn't forget, not too long ago, we had the same situation when we had to emigrate to France or Germany. I think all we needed was a smile and more support instead of xenophobia.
This is Conchita Rivas. She has been the chief of the Bermejales neighborhood since it was established. She is one of the public figures against the construction of the mosque. They claim they have no intention of insulting the Muslim community. They simply prefer a medical clinic to a mosque. Today, they are passing by an abandoned land with no mosque or any other construction in the public interest.
At the beginning, it was mentioned in the press that Muslims want to build the biggest mosque in Europe. We went to the municipality for some explanations, and they said that it had already been planned and there was nothing we could do about it. I told them that Bermejales community had also a part in making decisions. We'd had other important plans on the agenda and they hadn't been actualized yet. This is why we disagreed. However, we held a referendum in Paseo de Europa Park to decide the issue. In addition, on our left side, we had a related opinion box for saying yes or no to the mosque. There wasn't even one ballot paper in the ballot box.
A partir de ese momento en el que se hace esa asamblea informativa,
then we received information indicating that anything bad could happen. We tried the idea two times and they opposed us each time. We tried to sort things out.
Nosotros intentamos mediar en todos los aspectos, volvemos a hablar con ella.
We talked to them and we talked to the press to tell them they had no right to treat us like animals. Behind all this, there were also children at the school to whom the idea of xenophobia was indoctrinated by the neighbors. This issue was spreading nationwide. On the internet, we could see anti-mosque posts on websites from across Spain, Valencia, Madrid. We received emails and messages that had no indication of the term coexistence.
Documents and newspaper pieces are about the Mosque Project lawsuit, the project begun by the Muslim community. It was interesting to see the unusual presence of the National Intelligence Center at different stages of the whole issue, and both sides of the struggle mention this.
Yo fui visitada por dos agentes del Centro Nacional de Inteligencia.
I met with two officials in the National Intelligence Center. These people were trying to convince me that I had to forget about the whole thing. But I had my goals. I have always fought against injustice, ignorance, and whatever I'd find insulting. I told them that I wasn't going to give up.
Nuestras relaciones con los organismos de información del Estado son directas.
We were in direct contact with the CNI itself and the CNI police. In every aspect, we were frank and direct. We had nothing to hide from the society.
After a long lawsuit, the Supreme Court voted in favor of the neighbors, and the municipality was criticized for poor decision-making. Now, the municipality was trying to find a new place for the mosque. The new place was on Cartuja Island, where international exhibitions used to be held in 1992, a combination of abandoned, transferred, and constructed lands for educational and business purposes. The entrepreneurial community of Seville was the last to oppose the construction of the mosque. We chose three places: a church, a piece of land for public use in a newly built neighborhood, and a piece of land in an area for public services. Three projects, three hopes, three failures. But the Muslims did not give up. They chose another piece of land to buy in a neighborhood of San Jeromino. Once again, the neighbors took to the streets and the same scenes took place. Even some extremists buried a pig in the land chosen for the construction to make fun of Islamic law, which asserts pigs are unclean. The truth is that they wanted to stop them from building the mosque, no matter what. Finally, the whole project came to a halt.
I believe that this issue, apart from being politically motivated, was a problem of coexistence. And also another crucial factor can be the lack of understanding a civilization or a certain way of thinking. I think all these contributing factors sapped the mosque project. Personally, I truly believe that Muslims in Seville deserve a proper mosque.
It's hard to believe that a city like Seville, which was ruled by Muslims for more than five or six centuries with its Islamic background, has no place for Muslims to perform their rituals. Most of the neighborhoods oppose the idea of constructing a mosque, although more important issues can be found in these neighborhoods. We are in San Jeronimo, La Macarena. Since the time of economic crisis, this part of the city has been hit by depression. These people are losing everything. Yet, they demonstrate not against these crises, not against unemployment or their violated rights, but against their neighbors who want to build a place to do their rituals, simply because they don't understand the metaphysical values behind it. These people have no reason to stop the Muslims to build a mosque.
Whoever wants to be the Seville mayor has to know that the city needs a place to represent the Muslim community. Honestly, according to our constitution, our city deserves such a place. We will try to find another way with the help of the private sector to get this project done, and we hope to make it happen in the years to come. An unofficial census estimates the population of the Muslim community to be around 10,000, representing at least 20 different nations. Most of them are converted Spaniards, Moroccans, and others from southern parts of Africa.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
American protesters gathered in Fayetteville, North Carolina for a second night in a row on Monday, 10th of January, after a black man was killed by an off-duty sheriff's deputy. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Maya Yang. The piece is titled Fatal Shooting of Black Man by Off-Duty Officer Sparks Protests in North Carolina. American protesters gathered in Fayetteville, North Carolina for a second night in a row on Monday, 10th of January, after a black man was killed by an off-duty sheriff's deputy. The Fayetteville Police Department identified the man killed on Saturday as Jason Walker, a 37-year-old black man who the deputy told authorities jumped onto his vehicle. The Cumberland County Sheriff's Office identified the deputy as Jeffrey Hash. In a statement, Fayetteville police said a preliminary investigation revealed that Jason Walker ran into traffic and jumped on the moving vehicle. The driver of the vehicle shot Jason Walker and notified 911, it said. Jeffrey Hash, who has been with the Cumberland County Sheriff Department since 2005, was taken into custody but not arrested. On Monday, he was put on administrative leave, pending an internal investigation. By Tuesday, 11th of January, no charges had been filed. The Fayetteville Police Chief, Gina Hawkins, said data obtained from the black box of Jeffrey Hash's truck revealed that the vehicle did not impact anything or anyone, but a windshield wiper was torn off and used to break the windshield. Gina Hawkins said the weapon used by Sheriff's deputy, Jeffrey Hash, was not his service weapon. She did not disclose how many shots were fired or where Jason Walker was hit. Gina Hawkins asked the North Carolina Bureau of Investigation to take the lead in the investigation. Demonstrators challenged the police version of events gathering outside the Fayetteville Transit Authority and chanting, "What do we want? Justice. When do we want it? Now." Elizabeth Riggs, a trauma nurse, told WREL News she was on the scene and tried to save Jason Walker's life. "I did not see anyone in distress. The man was just walking home," she said. "It breaks my heart he didn't survive, and I'm trying to cope with that as well. I don't want to take away from Jason or the injustice, and I'm not going to be silent." A cousin of Jason Walker told WREL News the police chief's description of events did not sound like something Jason Walker would do. "We're hearing one side of the story that sounds like a person that Jason is not, and then on the other side we're hearing a story that makes complete sense," said the cousin, who was not identified by name. "We have to take it one day at a time. Hopefully the system does what is right and gets to the bottom of this. We really just want justice for Jason." According to Jason Walker's family, he was a single father and left behind a young son. On Tuesday, the prominent civil rights attorney, Ben Crump, said he would represent Walker's family. Ben Crump, who represented the family of George Floyd after he was killed by former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin in May of 2020, disputed the police account of Jason Walker's death. At the crux of the matter, Was Mr. Walker shot in the back as he tried to return home? His parents lived across the street, less than 100 yards away, Ben Crump said on Twitter. "We stand committed with the family and the young son that Jason Walker had left behind to find answers as to what happened to him when he was senselessly shot and killed by an off-duty deputy, Jeffrey Hash."
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Saving Capitalism, directed by Jacob Cornblue. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Clive Menzies, who is involved in Critical Thinking, a research and educational project which seeks to understand how the political economy works and identify levers for change. Now, Saving Capitalism is a documentary that explores the reasons why the economic system that once made the US strong is suddenly failing. The film is a clear-eyed examination of a political and economic status quo that no longer serves the people, exposing the powerful alliances between Washington and Wall Street, as well as the extreme wealth disparity in the US. And starring Robert Reich, and whose book inspired the film, served as Labor Secretary under President Bill Clinton, takes us through the US's fragile democracy and its fight for survival, and argues that it's up to ordinary US citizens to change the rules.
There's a huge amount of anger and frustration. So many people desperately wanting to be heard. And nobody is listening. It's up to us to change the rules. We are a two-tiered society composed of a few winners and a larger group of Americans left behind. And it's getting worse and worse and worse.
Thank you very much. Robert Reich, former Labor Secretary under President Clinton.
I want to go to places where I could actually interact. I really want to talk to people about their lives. Yes, that's true. As income and wealth go to the top, so does political power. People don't trust that our society is working for most people. Nobody in our society, the richest nation in the history of the world, should be working and not making it. The old assumption has been the division is Democrat versus Republican.
Yeah, something's way off all over the country. Right, left, everybody. Something's wrong.
This is about power. It's about reclaiming our democracy and reclaiming our economy.
This country is upside down, and it's not working for 99% of our society anymore.
We are at a critical turning point in this country, and this is dangerous. The only way forward is to get organized and politically active. New York now! New York now! Democracy is a very fragile thing.
It's now up to the next generation.
First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. So I found this film an enlightening watch, and I think it offers an effective crash course on US inequality, particularly on the economy. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Saving Capitalism?
It's a really easy film to watch. It's made in a kind of gentle, smoothly edited, it carries you along, it's intriguing, it's gripping. And Robert Reich is a really great central character. He's kind of warm and a little bit scruffy and impish and funny.
Very entertaining to watch.
He's very entertaining, and the things he says are incredibly pointed and they grab your attention. The central topic of the film is really strong. I don't know, I mean, the title is a little bit, I think, misleading almost, because I think it will put off a lot of viewers. Mm-hmm. But the central idea of the fact that, the economic system in America is tilted so heavily toward corporations, is a really important message that I think needs to get out there. And so you're watching it, you feel your blood starting to boil. It's one of those documentaries that starts making you more and more angry, mm-hmm. even as it kind of gives you some ideas of the way forward or what's likely to happen.
And so. Clive, if I could turn to you, as a political economist, what's your take on Saving Capitalism?
My first reaction was that it was something of a political pitch. And it was very articulate, very well done. It articulated the symptoms extremely well. Whether Reich's prescription for the remedy is appropriate, I would question, because it's the pendulum swinging back and forth. And Reich emerged in the 60s and 70s, and he seems to hark back to that as some sort of golden era, but that was just a temporary blip post-war, in this long war of attrition, which is effectively what they managed in the 60s and 70s, both in the UK and in the US, was some sort of social contract, which was a renegotiation of the terms of slavery. Mm-hmm. But slavery certainly wasn't abolished, and I'm not sure that the thrust of this film gets us any closer to abolishing slavery, which is effectively what this system is.
Well, I suppose this documentary could only cover so much ground in 90 minutes or so. But I'm just wondering, as someone who's not familiar with the economy, does this serve as a good introduction to get to grips with what capitalism is and the arguments that Reich makes?
Yeah, and I thought it was quite interesting. I was making notes as the film unfolded, and I was writing down names that I thought ought to have been mentioned. And sure enough, they come in. He mentions Robert Rubin as Treasury Secretary. And you look at the sort of Clinton administration dynamic, and to some extent, Reich was in there as the pigeon. And he fought very hard, and he said, my only regret was I didn't push harder. The irony is, he probably doesn't recognize that he couldn't have pushed harder, or he would have been out, or he wouldn't have got anywhere anyway. So I think it's, for all his 5 decades of experience, I'm not sure he's learnt the game sufficiently. He didn't realise the shark-infested pool in which he was operating.
Now, we see his character sort of, and his character progression throughout the documentary, actually, and how sort of down-spirited he becomes, but also hopeful as well. But Rich, just wanted to ask you, for viewers not well-versed with the economy, do you think this film serves as a good introduction then?
Well, it's very interesting. It's obviously from a particular point of view, but what it does explain in the way that I haven't heard explained quite so simply and straightforwardly is how the whole economy was founded on a principle that was flawed, mm-hmm. basically tilted toward the wealthy and corporations right from day one, mm-hmm. and how people with power just consolidate their power. So it's only gotten worse over the last 250 years, and it's just, you know, now the general average person in America has no power really politically, mm-hmm. which is quite a shocking thing to say. But when you think about it, it's true. And you look at the way laws are being passed and the way the government is behaving, mm-hmm. that's kind of how it's working. Mm-hmm. And but you see little, you know, people taking bites out of it. So I think the system has room to correct itself, and that helps. While you're watching the film, it helps you not be completely hopeless.
There's strong arguments indeed made in this film, and of course aided by great animation sequences, yeah. and graphics as well.
Yeah.
Intuition right now is clear. Something's wrong. All over the country, right, left, everybody. Something's way off.
The old assumption has been the division is Democrat versus Republican.
Yeah,
but faded. What we're beginning to see, yep. is that it's actually anti-establishment,
yeah.
versus establishment.
Yep.
It's people who don't want the big money and the crony capitalism versus the crony capitalists.
Yeah.
You know, Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, liberals, there's going to be disagreement on a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But if you could come together on these,
yeah.
fundamentals.
It's fine with me. You're at a deeper level, right? You've been teaching economics and all that for 30 years. I used to use your book.
You, yeah. used to use my book?
I used to use it.
Can
Work
we just make, can you?
And
can
I have a book out, too.
Can we get that again? Congressman, what do you think of the title?
Yeah, I know. It surprised me a little bit coming for you, but in a pleasant way. I think you and I are united on if we can do this in the right way, ethics and capitalism together, and we'll save the country.
I think what's interesting about this documentary is that Reich manages to put Republicans, both them and Democrats, around tables and get them to agree with him, actually, on this issue. And do you think Reich has sort of that political authority to do that?
Well, I mean, he is Democrat, so he's very kind of entrenched in that world. But I like the fact that he's looking beyond that. He's looking at the point that this is about an establishment, anti-establishment thing. He talks about Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump being anti-establishment. They're opposite ends of the political spectrum. But basically what they were proclaiming or what they were trying to do was the same thing, just overthrow the system. And, and that's quite interesting. It's quite interesting that he's brought them both into the story.
Indeed, and I think at the time, we see Trump there. It was early elections when they were, yeah. filming this documentary, and it was the front runners were Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton. But I don't think they could have foreseen that Trump would have won.
Well, no, nobody foresaw that.
No, not at all. But I think the argument made in the film, though, is perhaps this anti-establishment sort of notion is that Trump was bringing corporate power to influence political power, which, of course, this documentary highlights. So would you agree with that, Clive?
Undoubtedly. And we've seen what's happened since. Trump has populated his administration with Goldman Sachs alumni and the usual suspects. So the system is so corporate. Influence is so embedded in the system. And Reich talks about lobbying, but lobbying is the sort of the visible tip of the iceberg. It's basically embedded in the whole superstructure.
Well, the tax law that they passed was just purely aimed at helping corporations.
Exactly. So you know, the civil, what we call the civil servants in this country, the administrative engine is fully embedded with corporate interests and. The idea that changing the figurehead from red to blue or Democrat to Republican or vice versa is going to change anything. We saw it with Obama, we've seen it with Trump, you know, and you know, should this be a platform for another Bernie Sanders, it'll be exactly the same story. One has to question the system rather than the political flavor, and I think frankly I found that conversation with the Republican senator somewhat naive, really.
Oh, so, Rich, what do you think about, actually, the arguments made in this documentary about the relationship between political power and the economy and corporate interests? Does it make strong arguments bringing the two together?
Well, it does. I mean, it makes very strong arguments that the people who have the money have the power. It's kind of obvious. But it's quite creepy to watch a film like this where they explain how that plays out through the lobbying, through the passage of laws, through financial contributions to campaigns, and then getting, you know, favors on the back end of that. And you realize that the system is just kind of eating itself, and it's very much a it's perpetuating that corporate power and that kind of inequality to where the middle class is just shrinking and shrinking and shrinking.
So perhaps not surprising, but very telling.
It's not surprising, but it kind of helps you understand what's happening, because everybody knows this is happening, but nobody really gets why or how or how it's affecting them. And this kind of helps you understand it a little bit better, and perhaps gives you a voice. I mean, that's what this kind of film does. It might get people to stand up and say, wait a minute, something has
to happen. It's an empowering documentary. Yeah.
And there's a moment in the film where they mention that this happened 100 years ago, which is really interesting. The exact same thing. And there was a huge backlash. The public came out protest. They elected all new people. They passed all these laws, which have pretty much all been overturned now. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. It's interesting that, we're kind of repeating history. Mm-hmm. So
I would like to touch on that actually a bit more in the next section.
I've been working at McDonald's for 4 years. I work at the drive-thru window. I get paid $12.55 per hour. I make about $1,200 a month. $900 goes straight to rent, and I have to pay for gas, and then my phone bill. I end up with nothing. I sometimes have to go to the payday loan and get a loan on my paycheck in order to make it on time and don't get any late fees and try to make ends meet.
Nobody should be working full-time and not making it. Nobody in our society, the richest country, the richest nation in the history of the world, should feel as frightened and anxious and as insecure as so many people do today.
That was a truly heartbreaking scene to watch there. And Rich, what did you make of these sort of contributions to the documentary, these stories of McDonald's worker and also saw Farmer in the documentary also?
I think it's just an example of the thing that a lot of people are feeling, and it's regardless of what your political views are, that feeling like, why is life getting worse? Why is my paycheck not going as far as it went 5 years ago? Why do I feel like I'm earning less money and everything costs a lot more? There's something wrong here. When the wealthy people are just getting richer and richer and richer and richer, and they're buying cars and houses and they're living and they're talking about how booming the economy is, and I'm not feeling that. And those stories reflect that, reflect something that almost all of us feel, unless we're in that top 1%, I think.
And Clive, I want to ask that question that Robert Wright raises. Why is it that people who are working full-time are struggling to make ends meet in one of the richest countries in the world?
There's an inevitability in where we've got to. I referred earlier that the post-war consensus did actually give people some semblance of a decent life. They were working hard, but they were being well rewarded. They didn't have to have multiple jobs. But I think that respite was only temporary, and there's a much deeper underlying problem than what the documentary brings out. But what the documentary, the power of the documentary, is that it begins people on a journey of understanding. It may not go the whole way, but it certainly introduces concepts that may be totally alien to them, and having these stories actually puts them into the context of their own lives. But there is an inevitability to this idea that things get worse and worse, because essentially the wealth is sucked to the top, and there are very simple mechanisms that drive that. And it's to do with theft of what should belong to everyone, land, resources, etc., and usury, because it's just a straight interest on money. It's just a straight wealth transfer mechanism.
She said she had to take payday loans.
Exactly.
And of course,
so that just exacerbates
debt.
It. Mm. So this process, inevitably, in days gone by, we had debt jubilees. And basically everything would be forgiven, we'd start afresh, and the system would reset. 1929 was a reset, and that's why all those laws were so effective, because it reset the economy. We had a crash in 87, we had a crash in 98, we had a crash in 2000, we had one in 2008. We've not had a reset. All that's happened is that the Fed has continued to pile more money into the system, which has done nothing to alleviate the hardship of people like that lady at McDonald's, but it's gone into asset price. It's driving more of the wealth to the top. So the system needs a reset, And the fear is that the reset will be much too painful. It'll be like the 1930s depression. And if we want to avoid that, we have to think in a different way. That doesn't come out of the film, but if this starts people on a journey of understanding.
At least it's a good starting point, yes.
Yeah, I think it does a very good job of opening the door to concepts that people probably don't think about, although they feel them, as Rich says, on a daily basis in their own lives.
And Rich, before we move on, I just quickly wanted to touch on the point you made about Wright earlier on, about him. You can tell, you get a sense from the documentary, he's trying really hard, he's been a senior political figure in America, but it doesn't seem like he's getting anywhere, and you can see his spirits sort of go down throughout the years.
It's just you know, watching the system get worse and worse, and he talks about seeing the seeds of what we're seeing now, seeing it back in the 80s, you know, and realizing that this was going to happen. It was just going to get worse and worse. And
you can feel that sense of frustration from him.
Yeah,
also.
You do see him getting frustrated, and you saw him like in the clips from when he was working with Clinton, and he's trying to change things, and of course he can't, because every bill he proposes is heavily compromised by exceptions and things, and which just basically made the situation even worse. Mm-hmm. So you do watch him kind of getting more and more demoralized, and then this film is basically his journey around the country to try to make sense of that and work a way forward. It is, like you say, it's an opening of the door to the theme. It doesn't really get that deep into it, mm-hmm. but it helps you understand in a way that you kind of makes you think, and you think, oh, maybe I do need to pay attention to the candidates mm-hmm. more when the next election comes around, and pay attention to what they're saying.
Even in the insurance provider that I have, I was informed that they no longer cover chemo drugs fully. And so we were told by a medical social worker that we could potentially receive a bill for thousands of dollars. With the four drugs that I take for chemotherapy, the total comes out to about $3,000 a month per treatment. Well, for me, that's about 3 months of income just for one round of treatment.
What is the alternative to receiving your chemotherapy drugs? There isn't one. So whatever the cost is, you have to pay it.
You and I and everybody else in this country pays more for pharmaceuticals than any citizens of any advanced nation.
So you'd think medicine should save people, not bankrupt them. Rich, what impression did you get of the pharmaceutical industry from this documentary?
Personally, you know, I live in the UK, and our government right now is trying to create that system here, which is terrifying to me. That's terrifying.
Increasing privatization.
Yeah, and making it so that we have to pay for everything, even though we already pay for it. Mm-hmm. I find that really disturbing. But, this clip is part of a bigger point in the film, because he talks about how Americans pay more for airfares, they pay more for, you know, virtually everything. Internet access, mobile phones, everything is more expensive because of these special interests that have created laws that basically give them bigger profits. And that these companies are regulated outside of America because they're considered public utilities and they're not allowed to have obscene profits. Because they're utilities, they're something everybody has to have. And
it's essential.
And that's kind of the it's a bigger point in the film, is that these essential services shouldn't be allowed to make, you know, obscene profits
and
put people, you know, make people poor, basically.
Would you agree with what Rich said? Your thoughts on the sort of free-for-all economy?
On the pharmaceutical industry specifically, I think there's a deep misunderstanding of how we got here. Rockefeller was, one of the original Rockefellers was a snake oil salesman. And he basically, through endowing universities, medical schools, and health facilities, basically alienated the whole idea of natural medicine. That lady said there's no alternative. There are alternatives, actually effective alternatives. And the pharmaceutical industry is not about curing people, it's about making money. And if people get better, that's a side benefit. It's certainly not the main thrust. So the cost is part of this, but it's actually the industry itself is perpetuating illness because it's profitable. And if you look at the insured model, and Rich mentioned what's happening in this country, you go back pre the start of this privatization regime, management costs in the UK were about 4%. In America, they're 20% with this insured model. We're now at the last, there was a